I am an alcoholic. My name's Charlie Barnes. It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. It's always a pleasure to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. Josh, thank you for asking me to speak. Matt, thanks for the introduction, and thanks for giving my name and number to Josh. It's funny. I just got off of a meeting from a prison group that I normally go to on Wednesday nights. And since the COVID stuff hit, we can't meet in person. So we started a Zoom meeting so we could keep the meeting going on. We normally hold the meeting behind the walls of the Lexington prison in Lexington, North Carolina. If you'd ever told me that I'd be going into a prison to try to carry a message of hope to some people, I'd have told you it was a lie. The thought of anybody even wanting to hear what I had to say was so foreign from my mind, because see, when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was pretty sure that the world would be better off without me. I'd thought about dying or killing myself every day for probably the last year and a half. I hated all of y'all, because you'd show up wherever I was and you had smiles on your face, which to me meant that you were happy. I hated God because he'd given me a raw deal. And more than anything else, I hated myself. And by God's grace, by this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, y'all, the steps, I don't feel those ways today. We were talking in the prison meeting about guilt and shame. And, for a lot of years, I would feel the guilt, and, I'm very shame-based also. But I would push those feelings deep, deep down inside me. And I would pour alcohol on top of them. And it worked pretty good, because it kept those things bottled up inside of me. I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, though, and y'all told me I couldn't drink anymore. I was like, what? And a lot of that stuff started coming out. Early sobriety was not fun. It was so not fun that I did it, four or five times. Kept going out, kept coming back for more. I finally got back here. Like I said, I could not look at myself in the mirror. My sponsor at the time said, "You're a shoe guy, aren't you?" And I was a shoe guy, because whenever I talked to you, I was looking at my shoes, because I was ashamed of who I was and I was ashamed to be alive. We were reading in my home group the other day, Dr. Bob's Nightmare. And there's this one little sentence or two that really stuck out to me that I'm going to read. "My whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of anyone else, a state of mind which became more and more predominant as the years passed." And I think about how selfish I was. Like that sentence says, I did what I wanted to do. And I did it because I thought I needed to be okay. I was totally centered on me. Also when I got here, a lot of people told me that I had an alcohol problem, and that just flat wasn't the case. I've never had a problem with alcohol. From the first drink I ever took, to the last one I ever took, alcohol was always my solution. My problem was dealing with the guilt. My problem was dealing with shame. My problem was dealing with other unpleasant feelings of loss, of, you know, maybe being ignored, of dealing with people not doing what I wanted them to do. You're dealing with financial problems, dealing with family problems. That was my problem, was living life. For some reason, I don't know why, because I grew up in a really great family. A very loving family, a family that introduced me to God at an early age. A family that taught me many of the same, or tried to teach me many of the same spiritual principles that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't get it. I remember growing up, one of my earliest and longest fears, and still really one of the only ones that peeks its head out a little bit every now and then today, was that I'd be invisible. Was that you wouldn't notice me, because from an early age, I needed your approval. I needed you to see me. I needed to be important. I needed to stand out. And that's kind of the definition of ego. Ego doesn't mean I feel better than you. Ego means I feel different. I stand out in the crowd. I'm not just one of the bunch. It wasn't good enough just for me to be loved by my family. I had to be loved by everyone. I had to be popular. I wanted to be famous. And then I drank for a whole bunch of years and I ended up being anonymous. So that didn't work out at all. And my whole life I tried to do things, like it said, I did when I wanted, centered on myself without the rights or regards, or benefit of anyone else. I pursued a lot of things in my life. I pursued those friendships, not friendships with everybody, friendships with the cool people. I was really worried about how I looked in everyone's eyes. So I always tried to get into that cool crowd. Problem was, I wasn't very cool. So that didn't work out real well either. I always needed to have a lot of money, because money gave me the security that I was looking for. I always needed to have a woman. It's something that, I've never been able to find that one in my life. I'm 53 years old and I'm still single. I've never been able to find that one. And it was something that haunted me for years, starting when I was about 14, 15 years old. And it was one of those things, along with the money, along with the power and prestige, that I didn't get to my satisfaction. Those things ate at me. I don't know if any of y'all remember, there was a movie came out many, many years ago, starring Bo Derek. It was called 10. And the implication being that she was a 10. And see, my whole life, I've judged myself on that scale. And I judge myself based on the amount of money I had, the friends I had, whether there was a woman or not a woman, whether you were smiling and I wasn't, because one of the first things I really could relate to in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here, I heard somebody share that I compare your outsides with my insides, and I would see people who appeared to be successful and I knew how I felt. Yeah, and that would notch me down on that scale a little bit. And I was always trying to, my whole life was about competing and comparing myself with other people, trying to struggle to the top of the heap, just trying to get one notch higher. And I was never able to arrange my life in a way that I could do that. Prom night my junior year, something happened. I was kind of an overweight, geeky kid. I had red hair, I had glasses. which I really didn't think was cool at the time. Now I need them to read. So, you know, I was in the band. So needless to say, I didn't have a date to my junior prom. So me and about four other guys, we went out to Cedar Rock Park in southern Alamance County, a place about, you know, 30, 40 miles from Greensboro. And we were out there to this old abandoned building. And it was us and a half gallon of Everclear. You know, and we mixed it up. And something happened somewhere between the first red solo cup and the second red solo cup of our concoction. Something happened to me that I've heard several speakers talk about and explain that happened to them. Because see, I suddenly had the realization that everybody that I was with was a four. And I was a nine. I suddenly lost the fear of not being good enough. My whole life I've been afraid that I wasn't good enough. Even in my family who loved me unconditionally, I always felt like I had to do something in order to earn their love. And I knew I hadn't done it. And then the more I looked at what my actions as my life progressed, I knew I deserved it even less and less. You know, and that night at Cedar Rock Park, the fears went away. The fears of not being smart enough, the fear of not being cool enough or rich enough or popular enough or not having very good hair. And for the first time in my life, I was comfortable in my skin. Yeah, it was an amazing thing, you know, and I'm real grateful when I got here at Alcoholics Anonymous that they talked to me about the disease of alcoholism instead of talk to me about drinking. And they explained to me that, you know, the disease of alcoholism is threefold. There's a spiritual illness first. There's something missing in your life. There's a physical allergy that, you know, if I drink alcohol, something physical happens in my body that makes me crave more alcohol. And when they explained that to me, it made a whole lot of sense, you know, because there were a lot of things, you know, when I drank, stuff happened. And it wasn't always stuff that I had planned. There were a lot of, you know, there were a lot of situations where, you know, I wanted to show good for the people that were around me. I remember this is shortly before I got sober. We had a manager's conference in Charleston, South Carolina, and I had actually stopped drinking prior to this because it had, you know, around Christmas, Christmas or, you know, first of the year, it had gotten so bad. And I went to church. I joined a church and started going there because I knew I needed to do something about my drink. And it worked for a short time, but I went to this manager's conference and these were, you know, all the big wigs of the company. And I was living in Memphis, Tennessee at the time and running our branch that was out there. So I went to the conference, and I remember sitting on the plane telling myself over and over again, you're not going to drink. You're not going to drink. You're not going to drink. Got to the hotel. And I couldn't find anybody. And somebody said, they're around the corner in the bar. And I said, well, you know, but of course, that's where people in my company generally hung out. So I went over there and, you know, I'm telling myself, just have a Dr. Pepper. You're just going to have a Dr. Pepper. So I walked in, walked up to the table where my boss was sitting. And right as I got to the table, the waitress delivered him a beer. Well, he and I drank the same kind of beer. So first thing he does is he slides it across the table to me. And without any thought, I picked it up and drank it. That night ended up being a blur. The next morning we showed up for the meeting and went to a little bar around the corner for lunch. And after about my 12th Bloody Mary, I wandered out of the bar and disappeared. You know, and this is about 11 o'clock in the morning, 11 to 12 o'clock in the morning. I didn't show back up until about 5 a.m. the next morning. And everyone in the company was looking for me. You know, there were like 40 sticky notes inside the room. Call this person when you get back. I come to find out that they had called the hospitals. They had called the police department. They'd called the morgue. They had scoured all of downtown looking for me. And it was a huge scene. You know, and I was so embarrassed because I wanted to show good for that group of people. There was another time I was drinking in Chapel Hill. We were playing bar golf. And, you know, which is you go to one bar, you know, and you have a drink, and then you go to another bar and have another drink, and then you go, you know, and so on down the street. And the last bar we went into, my buddies that I was with were an alcoholic. And I walked in and I was like, come on, let's go get a drink. And they said, no, thanks. We've had enough. We're really starting to feel it, which I absolutely don't understand. So I went to the bar, and while I was up at the bar, I saw this girl. She was looking at me and smiling. And she was fairly attractive. So I kind of sauntered over there, you know, got my swerve on and, you know, started talking the talk. And somewhere in the, you know, and this has all been told to me. I was in a total blackout. I don't remember it. Somewhere in the conversation, she looked at me and she said, Charlie, you're not sure who I am. You don't know who I am, do you? And she said, my eyes got about this big. You know, because that's scary when somebody walks up. If you're an alcoholic, it's scary. Somebody walks up to you and says, I know you, and you have no clue who they are. And, you know, just fear entered in my eyes. And she said, I sat there and stared at her for a long time. And finally I said, Rita. It was my stepsister. another thing, I did not want that to happen. I did not plan on that happen, but it made sense. It made sense to me with that explanation of the allergy, because once I started drinking, I always lost control. I never knew how much I was going to drink, and I never knew what I was going to do. Yeah, there were a lot of nights I didn't get into trouble and I held on to them, but there were a lot of nights that I did. And it all started with that first drink. You know, what I didn't get was the allergy. And I believe the allergy was born that night at Cedar Rock Park, because what alcohol did for me that night was so powerful. You know, I was 16 years old and I spent the next 12 years chasing that feeling, trying to get back to Cedar Rock Park, trying to get to that level of freedom and release from the burden of life. It's all I ever wanted. You know, all I ever wanted in my entire life, you know, I thought my life was so complicated, but you know, the only thing that I ever wanted was peace and happiness. The money, the women, the popularity, the fame, all of that stuff just pointed to a deeper need, because I thought I needed those things to be okay. I thought I needed those things to be happy and at peace. Alcohol was always my solution. When I couldn't get life straight, alcohol is what took care of me. And it kept those negative feelings at bay, and it removed me from right now. See, right now is the time that I don't know how to handle. Right now, I got to get out of the moment. I have to numb myself so I don't feel the pain of just being alive. You know, I'm going to tell you the story that changed my life, saved my life. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gotten sober. If I didn't say, my sobriety date is March 17th of 1996. And I'd gotten sober, and this was probably, maybe April, maybe May, probably not a whole lot later than that. And I was standing in the back of the Unity Club in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I'd kind of gotten to know this guy, who I thought he was kind of weird. I kind of thought all of y'all were weird. But I'd kind of gotten to know this guy a little bit, but not very much. Because, see, I was one of those guys who showed up right before the meeting started, and I left right when it was over. I took y'all's suggestions of going to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings. I averaged about 20 meetings for 2 years, 20 meetings a week for about 2 years. And I worked full time and hung out with people a lot. So I went to a whole lot of meetings, but I didn't take a whole lot of the other suggestions. I wouldn't get to know people. But this guy, this guy walks up to me after the meeting and he says, "Charlie, hey, so a bunch of us are going to eat some ice cream after the meeting." He said, "And would you like to go?" And see, I was still, I'm an isolator. I hate myself and I don't want to be around people because you might discover my secret. See, I was real good at putting a smile on my face and wearing that mask and trying to be who I thought you wanted me to be, and in treatment, after I got out of treatment, I had a pretty good memory at the time, and I'd remember things that people shared and I'd share them in a little bit different way and everybody would applaud and I got most likely to succeed coming out of treatment because, just everybody loved me and I said all the right things and didn't have a clue what I was saying, but, I spoke in bumper stickers. Live and let live and first things first. And I love the slogans today, but I was just throwing them out to make y'all think that I had this. And when you feel that way about yourself, you don't want to be around other people. So I came up with the first lie that I could say. And after he asked me to go eat ice cream and I said, "No, I'm sorry. I don't have any money." Is there anybody new here? By chance, anybody in your first 6 months? Okay. You're going to hear, you may hear that God speaks through the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to tell you that night God had a dirty mouth. Because what he said back to me was, "Charlie, I didn't ask you if you had any bleeping money." He said, "I asked you if you wanted to go eat some ice cream." And I was caught. Because I'd already told him, "I'd go, but I don't have any money." And what happened is I went out with those guys that night and I socialized with them outside of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I had a good time. And the world didn't end because I was socializing with decent people. Because see, by the time I got to the end of my drinking, I had lowered my standards on the people that I hung out with so much so that it would fit with the kind of life that I was living. And I was very ashamed early on in Alcoholics Anonymous because y'all looked like you were good people living good lives. And I knew I didn't belong. And that guy, that night that guy reached out and asked me if I wanted to go eat ice cream, saved my life. Because I started hanging out with the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a big fan of prayer and meditation. I've been accused of being a big book thumper from time to time. I love the big book. I love the 12 and 12. I'm a big fan of the steps. But it was the people of Alcoholics Anonymous that saved my life. If it wasn't for the people that I developed relationships with early on, who I saw and talked to on a regular basis, I would not be here tonight. It's something when Matt was in Greensboro, he can attest to, we were hanging out all the time. We were going to eat. We were going to have coffee. We were going over to my grand sponsor Scott's house and sitting around the table playing cards and reading the big book. And I was around people all the time. Early on in sobriety. See, because I needed the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to keep me sober long enough so that the steps could start taking effect. You know, and I got into the steps. What time is it? Oh, we're good. You know, and I started off on the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were three really important things that happened to me that first summer. Number one, I'd done a fourth step. I had started working on a fourth step, and I did a fairly thorough fourth step, I thought. I had about 50 pages of resentments. You know, my sponsor told me I probably wrote too many, and I said, well, you know, I'd rather have erred on too many than erred on not enough. So I did a four step. Something Matt and I both got involved in service. We went to a young people's conference in Charlotte, and there were a few of us that were there that decided we wanted to start a young people's conference in North Carolina. And that summer, we kicked off the bid to have the conference in Greensboro, which we won. And so for the first couple of years, I was doing Nicky Pa service work every night of the week, almost, starting that summer. The third thing that happened that absolutely changed my life is I went on a 12-step call. I haven't been on a 12-step call in a long time. I miss them. I guess everybody's just going to treatment first. But went on this call with this guy. I was coming into the Unity Club after work, and this guy said, "Hey, come on, come with me." And I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "Shut up, get in the truck." And they didn't treat me very nicely back then. So I shut up and got in the car, and somebody else had done something with another friend of mine. He ended up in the back seat, and we went to see this guy. We get to this guy's house, and the guy's still drinking. You know, he had called our inner group, and they'd called the Unity Club, which is where I was, and we were the guys that went. Yeah, I'm about 6 months sober. I am probably 98% finished with my fourth step. Not quite. I haven't done a fifth step yet. And I'm about to bust. And we started sharing with this guy, and he's like, "You know, what you're saying sounds so good, but you don't understand." He started his sentences with the same things that I always did. My grand sponsor, or he was really my sponsor, he walked up to me one day and he said, "Charlie, are you part frog?" And I told you all he was a weird guy. So I was like, "What are you talking about, dude?" He goes, "Are you part frog?" And I said, "No, why would you ask me that?" And he said, "Because you start every sentence with yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but." So anyway, we're in this guy's house, and we're telling him about the fellowship. We're telling him about all the stuff we do. We're telling him about the kind of life we have today. And he's, "Yeah, but you don't understand. I've done some really bad things." And we assured him that he hadn't done anything that any of us hadn't done, but he wasn't having it. Finally, he did something that was pretty stupid. He challenged us, and he said, "Okay." He said, "Tell me some of the worst stuff y'all have done." And they started on one side, and they got down to me at the end. And like I said, I was a shoe guy. I was staring at my shoes while I was talking to him. And, you know, like I said, I was just about done with my fourth step, and I was about to bust. The stuff had to come out. And I just went, bleh. And I don't know what I said, but I just spewed out some of the stuff that I'd done. And I finally looked up from staring at my shoes, and the guy was sitting there with his mouth hanging open. And he got up, walked to the kitchen, and poured out his beer. And he started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with me, with us. That day, something changed. Because, see, I had just told him all my dark secrets, all the things I was ashamed about, the things I felt guilty about, things that were really wrong, and it helped another person. For the first time, I realized that my dark past could be of use to someone else. For the first time in my life, I started to realize that maybe there was a purpose for me here on earth, that maybe the world wouldn't be better off without me in it. And from that day to this, I've done everything I can when it's possible to try to be there for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because see, what happened when I came into AA, and I'm reading through the book with a bunch of my sponsees, and one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, the book only says one thing about what we need to do with alcohol. It says, we recommend entire abstinence. You don't need a whole book to say that. The rest of the book deals with my mind. The rest of the book deals with how I can live life sober. Because see, sober's the problem. Drinking wasn't the problem. Sober's the problem. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me how to live sober. And it's done that. It didn't happen overnight. But over time, you know, one of my favorite of the Ninth Step promises that a lot of people read at every meeting is you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And I remember the first time that something happened in my life and it didn't bother me. And I knew it should have. I knew had it happened 6 months ago, it would have. But I was growing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and today it didn't bother me. That was a new freedom. And I kept, and I've kept getting those the longer I stay here and the longer I try to practice these principles in my life. I thought I was the poster child of Alcoholics Anonymous for about the first 10 years that I was sober, because I did more service work than anybody I knew. And I was real proud of myself for that. And my life was getting better. And I'm not saying that, you know, everything I did was false or anything else. I think everything I did was probably just part of the process. But I'd read and studied and learned a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I was the authority of Alcoholics Anonymous in my, you know, not consciously, but kind of in the back of my mind. I thought I kind of had this thing. And then at about 12 years sober, my life started falling apart. I worked in the mortgage industry. It was 2007. If anybody remembers 2007, that wasn't a good time to be in the mortgage industry. The company I worked for closed. The job and the stuff that I specialized in, you know, because I'd been able to grow in the company and I was doing pretty well for a guy my age. And what I did doesn't exist anymore. So my specialty that I'd worked so hard for was gone. You know, so I was out of a job, didn't have another one really to go to at the time. And then things started happening. I had two or three, I told you the woman thing has been a problem in my life, and I had two or three absolute heartbreaks just kind of back to back. I'd be starting to get over the last one, and another one would happen, and then another one would happen. I had a total financial reversal. I tried to be self-employed, and it failed miserably. You know, it was 2007, 2008, 2009, just failed miserably in the market at the time. So, you know, everything I'd built up to that point in time was basically gone. I had several friends that I felt betrayed me. I realize today, I'm not sure if that really happened. I've had a lot of things that have happened in my life that I've realized in time never really happened, but I had some friends that I thought betrayed me. I had a couple people close to me die. I had several sponsees that got drunk just all in succession. And during about a 3-year period, it seemed like about every other month and a half or 2 months, another bomb would drop, and then another bomb would drop, and then another bomb would drop, and another bomb would drop. Yeah. And I kept looking to God and saying, God, come on, how much more can I handle? And I started getting very angry. I started getting very angry at God. And, you know, finally it kind of culminated, with a really bad ruptured disc in my back that I've become disabled from. I'm very grateful because I was looking at total paralysis from the waist down, and that hasn't happened. But I've lived in constant pain, fairly severe pain, for about the last 10 years. You know, with that, it brought on depression. With that, it brought on anxiety. With that, it kind of brought on, I'm not able to go out and hang out with my friends and things anymore, so I don't really have a running buddy anymore. I can't work, so I'm never going to have that money, you know, that I want. And I still don't have that woman. And I got to a place that was so dark, it was worse than my bottom coming in. And one day I was talking to God angrily. If any of y'all have ever seen Forrest Gump, it was my Lieutenant Dan moment. And I was screaming at God. And I said, after all I've done for you, I can't believe you've done this to me. And God gave me the grace that I heard what I said. And I heard the arrogance behind it. And I saw the mixed motives. See, because I was pursuing this relationship with God. I didn't realize that I had this expectation. But I'd heard so many AA speakers talking about getting the girl, getting the job, retiring well, having kids, having grandkids. You know, just living the beautiful life, and none of that has happened to me. And I realized that my whole life I was pursuing that relationship with God for what I thought he was going to do for me, just like every other relationship I'd ever had. You know, there were always strings attached. And I started pursuing a relationship with God for the sake of God, period. That if nothing ever changes in my life, God helped me to seek that security through you, the security that I thought I needed money for. Help me to seek that love through you, the love that I thought I needed a woman for. You know, help me to seek esteem through you, the esteem that I thought I needed by gaining your respect and your affection. And I started seeing that everything that I've ever wanted, God can provide. You know, in the big book, it says we get down to causes and conditions. And there's a little part on the fourth step. It's mostly overlooked. People rarely talk about it. People normally talk about the second list, the my part of the end, or where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. It's that third column of the first list. And it affects my esteem, society, you know, personal relationships, sex relationships, and security. Those four or five things have driven me and controlled my life much more than alcohol ever tried to, you know, much more than alcohol did. Yeah. And it's only through, you know, I want to read something out of the 12 and 12 that really helped me a lot. Where are my glasses? Yes, sir. Until now, our lives have been largely devoted to running from pain and problems. We fled from them as the plague. We never wanted to deal with the fact of suffering. If I didn't have enough money, I fled from that problem by trying to get more money. If I didn't have the girl, I fled from that problem by having promiscuous sex with whoever, you know, or continuing to try harder and harder to get the girl. You know, if I felt like I wasn't good enough, I fled from that problem, you know, by trying to show out and trying to impress you with all kinds of different crazy actions. It was these desires for that controlled my life. It says, escape through via the bottle was always our solution. And for me, when I couldn't get my life right, and when I could get my life right, the bottle became my solution more and more until it absolutely had control of me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember collapsing on my floor, being afraid to live and afraid to die, knowing I couldn't go on drinking the way that I was drinking and living the way that I was living, and knowing that there was no way I could face life without drinking the way that I was living, you know, drinking the way I was drinking and living the way that I was living, you know? And it says character building through suffering might be all right for the saints, but it certainly didn't appeal to us. Then in AA, we looked and listened. Everywhere we saw failure and misery transformed by humility into priceless assets. We heard story out of story after how humility brought strength out of weakness. In every case, pain had been the price of admission to the new life. But this admission price purchased more than we expected. It brought a measure of humility, which soon discovered to be a healer of pain. See, I always tried to cover up pain with more women, more money, more whatever. I've heard this is a disease of more. I always had to have more of everything. And I realized that I finally realized through working these steps and pursuing this relationship with God for the sake of God, that I don't need more. That I don't have to compare and contrast myself anymore. Because see, as long as I have God in my life, it doesn't matter whether I'm good enough or not. It doesn't matter whether I'm a 1 or a 10. I don't even have to look at it because I've got God. Since we began to fear pain less and desire humility more and more. Nothing has changed in my life, really, since that period that I told you all about, except that I'm in more pain. I'm in a little bit better financial state. But today I'm grateful for that period of my life more than anything else. Because I started to see that this pain could lead me to a better relationship with something that, for the first time in my life, something that really works, a relationship with God. During that period, I listened to the song, and it's one of my favorite songs. If you've never heard the song, look it up on YouTube after the meeting. The name of the song is Blessings, and the artist is Laura Story. And the song goes like this. What if our blessings come as raindrops? What if our healing comes through tears? What if 1,000 sleepless nights are what it takes to know you're here? And my favorite line in the song says, what if our greatest disappointments or the achings of this life are the revealing of a greater thirst that this world can't satisfy? I've always had that thirst. If I could just quench the thirst, I'd be okay. Don't care whether it was money, women, alcohol, or whatever, I needed it. And I realized today that none of that stuff ever works. What I have today, but through y'all, most days I'm happy. Most days, you know, and truly most days, I do not feel sorry for myself because of the condition I'm in. That amazes me because I'm a whiner, you know, and, you know, and I don't feel sorry. I'm very grateful for the problems in my life because they've helped me relate to more people. They've allowed me to help more people. And that's what gives me the great joy today. This is a true ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. And I'm so grateful that I have that today. I want to tell you one more story. I was in my talk with this. Do I have time? Okay, I'll make it quick. I hadn't seen my mom, toward the end of my drinking, hadn't seen my mom in a real long time. And finally, I couldn't put it off anymore. So I flew to Atlanta, Georgia to see her. She met me at the gate. She was so excited to see me. She talked the whole way home. And I was just, I'd been up for 3 days doing what we do. And I was just basically unresponsive to her. And we got home and I said, Mom, I'm tired. I'm going to go take a nap. So I went up and took a nap for about 3 hours. When I woke up, I felt bad about it, you know, because she was so, I knew she was excited to see me and just wanted to talk to me. That's all she wanted was just to talk to me. And I had kept her out of my life. I went downstairs and I apologized because that's what I do. I don't change any behavior, but I'm good at apologizing. And she said, that's okay. Just having you here in the house, just having you near me, made me happier and more peaceful than I've been in a long time. Now, I want everybody, if you could, close your eyes for a minute and imagine someone in your life who, you know, when they walk in the room, makes you just feel safe. If they're in the room, you're at peace. Could be a father, a parent, a child, maybe your sponsor, your best friend. Imagine what life could be like if you had that feeling all the time. I'm here to tell you, work these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can have that relationship with the God of your choosing, whose spirit is with you all the time, who gives you that peace, who gives you that joy, that spiritual joy. Bill said, we don't need to look any further for utopia. We have it right here, right now. Can you feel the presence even on Zoom? Thank you for showing me. Thank you for loving me until I learned how to love myself. Thanks.